Live from London, this is The Late Show with Emily Follow Run Show on Teachers Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody. It is 8 p.m. and you're listening to me, Emily Follow Run Show, and I am going to be joined by two special guests, and we are going to be talking about all things pastoral. We will be talking about heads of year tips, as well as dealing with difficult and challenging students. So stay tuned, pose your questions, and send in your scenarios.
Live from London, this is The Late Show with Emily Follow Run Show on Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live on the Podbean app or desktop player. Just head over to www.podbean.com/lsw/ttradio or search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio.
So, hello everyone, and I hope you had a great start to your second week or third week, whatever week it is for you. Today we will be coming back to our pastoral series and we will be finalising it. I'm really excited with the guests that I have. I've got a head of year as well as my colleague as well that has extensive experience within pastoral. So as always, please do share the show. Please do send in your questions, or even better, please do call in. So my first guest is Rosie, and I've been following Rosie since I've joined Twitter, and you know, she shares so amazing resources for history. So Rosie is a history teacher with 80 years experience, and she's currently a head of year at Wally Range in Manchester. Rosie has an MA in education, teaching and learning, and as a middle leader continues to lead on whole school developments, including communication and most recently instructional coaching. So I can see Rosie's in the room, so please do call in when you're ready, Rosie. I'm really excited to have you on board because I know a lot of people want to get into being a middle leader, especially in pastoral. So I believe, you know, the wisdom that you will share will be invaluable. So some of the questions I will be asking Rosie today is tips for those that want to get into pastoral. I will also be asking her about, you know, how to balance being a teacher as well as being a head of year, because I know it is very challenging. Hi, Rosie. How are you?
Hi, Emily. I'm really good, thanks. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I really appreciate you coming on because I know how manic it is at the start of the academic year.
Absolutely.
Especially as a head of year. So thank you so much, Rosie. And as I said to you before on Saturday, I'm just really excited to interview you because I feel like you know, we interact a lot on Twitter, but we've never really met in person. I've never heard, you know, what your voice sounds like, so it's amazing. I feel like this is like the most kind of physical contact I've had with you, if that makes sense. In a weird way. So yeah, I really appreciate it. And as I said earlier on, my dog, sorry about that. As I said earlier on, you know, I've been following you since since I started Twitter, and I remember, you know, the amazing resources that you share. And I really do want to ask, you know, how, because you know, you're really big in the history community, so how you balance, you know, being that academic side, which I know you really love, with being a head of year. So I can't wait to ask you that. But before I get into all the questions, please do introduce yourself. I did give a brief introduction at the beginning of the show.
Brilliant. Thanks, Emily. So I am Rosie Culkin-Smith, and I am currently a history teacher, and I am head of year 8 at Wally Range 11 to 18 High School, which is in Manchester. And we're part of a multi-academy trust, the Education and Leadership Trust. And I have worked at Wally Range now for 8 years. It has literally been almost an impossible school for me to leave, really, because of the brilliant opportunities that I've had from colleagues and superiors, and also the students who are absolutely brilliant. And I know, Emily, you worked, or I think you trained quite close
to me.
Yeah,
close, yeah, I did. Loved it, absolutely loved it.
Yeah, so for a long time, really, and obviously it still is, my passion had been in history teaching. I did a master's in education, so that specialised in teaching and learning, and you know, again, that still is one of my passions. But I had the opportunity to step up to become. We previously were in a house system, but a head of house. And this kind of happened in the middle of the pandemic. I had this opportunity. And here I am, ahead of year. I've been ahead of year now for about 2 years. And it's a very rewarding role. It's a very busy role, but it's a very rewarding role. And I think it's a role that's quite special because you kind of get a bit of an insight into a school and its students that perhaps not all staff do. And I think that that's quite special.
Yeah, and because I know, you know, you're really big in a history community, and I can see, you know, teaching and learning is your passion. How, you know, and you briefly spoke about how, you know, being ahead of year has fallen onto your lap. So how has the transition been from, you know, curriculum to pastoral?
To be honest, it was something that I was quite well, I thought about it a lot when I officially kind of got the role, and kind of initially, you kind of, before stepping up to a new role, and to be honest, it's probably like this with any role that your new role that you're taking on, you get this kind of imposter syndrome. It felt very new, and there were lots of elements of the role that were very different to your kind of normal teaching role, kind of your very typical pastoral things like the monitoring of attendance, punctuality, behaviour, not just for your own classes, but on a much kind of wider responsibility. But then what I realised as you kind of continue in the role is that all those kind of familiar aspects of teaching became more apparent. So all those kind of learning and restorative conversations that you would have with students in your lessons anyway became kind of more apparent. And I think I kind of used that to kind of boost my own kind of confidence and kind of move forward. One of the big things with the transition from curriculum to pastoral is, without a shadow of a doubt, and I'm sure most heads of year would also discuss this, is the amount of communication that you have with parents. I think as a classroom teacher, quite often you may only, you know, have a lengthy conversation with, you know, student parents at a parents' evening, or perhaps when you've written a report, and there may be the odd call throughout the year based on, you know, some positive feedback, or perhaps if there was a particular issue. But I think the biggest thing for me was that crucial role and the, you know, huge increased communication with parents, and that kind of almost like triangulated approach to the students, you know, academic progress and well-being. So that was that was a transition for me, and something that was quite eye-opening.
Thank you for that. And how have you balanced it? Because I speak to many, you know, heads of years. I've got friends as well that are heads of years, and then they say, like, the difference between being a pastoral head of year and an academic head of year is the fact that, you know, you think as a pastoral head of year, you think you've got your free period, but actually you don't have that free period because it's always taken by something else. So totally. How do you, you know, balance like planning and marking and, you know, all of that typical classroom teacher stuff alongside, you know, your pastoral role and, you know, you being called upon at any time?
Yeah, definitely. Well, It took me a while to get in the flow, and I'm, you know, if you speak to any of my colleagues or even my friends, like, I am a very organized person, and, you know, I'll know what I'm doing in that lesson and that period or after school. But I think that I quickly realized as a head of year that your days aren't always your own, and that was difficult to kind of adapt to, really. But, you know, based on me as a person as well, I'm quite particular with my organization. Same. And I think it was, I think it was a lot of acceptance that your days aren't your own. And, you know, the head of year role can be very, very reactive and very, very organic. So the main way for me was, first of all, kind of that realization and the acceptance that not everything was going to get done. I had to be really realistic about that. And one of the biggest things was you really learn how that you have to effectively prioritize. Your time management becomes a real skill. And also just kind of working around a schedule that works for you. So for me personally, I know that in the school day, so when the students are in school, that I will most likely be, you know, resolving student issues, speaking with parents, perhaps attending meetings. There'll be a duty at some point. So I know that in that time that my, you know, my time is dedicated to working with those students. So what I tend to do is I would, you know, come into work maybe a little bit earlier. I try and always be there for about 7:30. That's when I kind of, you know, I'll go through my emails, I'll send out notices to form tutors, I'll make sure that, you know, everything's printed and sorted for my teaching lessons. Like I said, the day is that kind of reactive element. And then in the afternoon, when everybody goes home and it's nice and quiet, that's the time for me to do like my lesson planning and things like that, which I really actually enjoy. The stillness at the end of the day and the office is quiet. But I think, you know, as heads of year, and I'm sure other heads of year would give this advice to somebody that wanted to become a head of year, you've just got to be realistic. And, you know, some days will be quiet and it'll be very strange, but then some days may be a little bit manic and you're kind of pulled, you know, from toe to tail.
Do you think having, you know, conversations with other heads of years, the common thing is, you know, they were such a perfectionist when it came to lesson planning and teaching. Do you feel like your teaching and planning has suffered just a bit because of this new role, or are you still finding your feet?
Yeah, I think, you know, you've got to be honest with yourself. And particularly last year, I was completely new to the role last year. I was head of year seven. So bearing in mind these students hadn't had, you know, any kind of transition into secondary school, there were days, you know, where you felt like it wasn't the, you know, the best lesson that you have ever taught. And, you know, Emily, you know what I'm like with the things that I plan and the lessons that I like to teach. I think, again, there's just got to be, you've got to kind of make, you know, you've got to humanize it and remember that at the end of the day, you're a human and you can only do what you can do. I'm really lucky to be in a school that really kind of emphasizes the sharing of good practice, and my history team at school are absolutely brilliant, and we're all very active in kind of sharing our lessons with one another, or if someone's planned something brilliant, they'll share it across. And I feel like that really, really helps, particularly me. I know it benefits other colleagues as well, but particularly me, where, you know, I could have set aside some time in the morning to do something and then something happens and all of a sudden I've got 5 minutes before period two starts, for example. So definitely sharing with colleagues and, you know, again, like even asking for help, does anybody have this? And again, Emily, you'll know, like, Twitter is brilliant for this. And I think that that's, you know, it's really important. I'm not going to be a martyr here and say, oh, my teaching is always perfect, because I think as a head of year and as a normal teacher, class teacher anyway, when it's busy, it's impossible.
I'm sure that is because, you know, I just look at other heads of year, especially my school, and they're just always so busy. And yeah, thank you so much. I think you've, you know, those that are listening and those that are listening back, I think Rosie shared, you know, some excellent organisational tips, especially for those that may have also transitioned from, you know, being a classroom teacher or working the academic side into pastoral. So thank you, Rosie, for, you know, some of those strategies that you've shared. My next question is about, you know, training and CPD as a head of year. In the second series of the pastoral series, I interviewed Lewis Everett, and we I'm sure you've seen him on Twitter. And and he mentioned, you know, he's really big in the history community, and now he's transitioned into being, you know, a vice principal for pastoral. And he's mentioned about his CPD provision, and that kind of blew my mind because I always see like CPD on Twitter to do with, you know, curriculum, teaching and learning, but, you know, the pastoral element is neglected, I think, in that aspect. And my question to you is, did anything prepare you for this role? And if so, or if not, what CPD do you think all heads of year should have?
Yeah, I completely agree there. And, you know, it's really interesting. I remember when I was going for the role, and obviously, like I said, we were in the middle of the pandemic. And when I was kind of researching, you know, about kind of pastoral provision and the role of the head of year, it kind of really struck a chord that whilst the teaching profession is moving towards such kind of research-based education, and a lot of like our, you know, our curriculum design and our teaching and learning is so like heavily rooted in research, like you said, that the research on the pastoral kind of side of things is very minimal, if not, you know, slightly on the way up. So for me, in terms of whenever I'm preparing for anything, I like to read. I like to read research because a lot, I think, you know, research-based teaching is proven to be
effective.
Yeah. So I was really surprised at the kind of the lack of research, but I did find a couple of bits of research. Obviously, the EEF published some really, really brilliant stuff, and that's something that I read to kind of prepare for the role. And also, I need to give a bit of a shout out to Stephen Lane, who is, as people more commonly know him on Twitter as Sputnik Steve. He has recently brought out a book last year called Beyond Wiping Noses.
I've never heard of that.
It's absolutely brilliant, and it's, you know, the whole concept is around this idea that, you know, being ahead of year is beyond wiping noses and kicking butts, is his phrase, which I really liked. And he shares some really, really kind of insightful and research-based approaches to pastoral care and in being ahead of year. So I would say that the second thing that I think is like really important as well is kind of being a form tutor. The pastoral provision within a school, you know, starts with being a form tutor. You know, what you're doing in that morning slot with your form is quite similar to what your heads of year are doing, albeit they're doing it on a slightly bigger scale. So you know watching other form tutors, I you know had the opportunities of being paired with other colleagues in a form, and you know, really kind of nailing that role, I think is really, really, really useful. And again, Twitter and networking, I'm really lucky to have some really good friends that are heads of year, and speaking with them and shadowing them. I had started to shadow with one of my really good friends and colleagues just before the pandemic, and then obviously that was halted, but definitely shadowing is a really good way to prepare. So just in what you were saying about your second question there about CPD and what all heads of year should have, I think that there definitely needs to be, you know, the biggest thing, and I'm sure that Lewis probably talked about this, the first thing is obviously safeguarding.
It's a
huge part of the role of being ahead of year, and an increased understanding and awareness of safeguarding and how to keep our students safe is obviously a paramount. There's a lot of kind of work and research as well about restorative conversations, and that seems to be taking quite a front seat at the moment. So CPD with that, being a big part of ahead of year is de-escalation between students and teachers, restorative justice as well, dealing with friendship breakdowns. And I think as a new head of year, going into a situation like that, that you may never have to deal with, a friendship breakdown before, having, CPD on that element of restorative justice is super important. And I think like the biggest thing that's kind of coming out even more so because of COVID now is mental health.
Mm-hmm.
And increased training with regard to how supporting students with mental health and anxiety. We're really lucky to have such a brilliant health and wellbeing team that work within our school and liaise with lots of fabulous external agencies. And they have provided us with some really, really great bits and bobs in doing that. But I think that's going to be, a key thing moving forward with regard to, key CPD for all heads of years as we kind of move our way out of the pandemic.
I definitely agree with you. And TSCW in the chat has said, YMHFA, I'm not sure what that is, I feel embarrassed, training is valuable for heads of years. Ideally, all teachers should have it. I haven't heard of YM.
No.
Have you heard of it? Please put more detail in the chat, or please do call in to explain more. TCW. Oh, so it's Youth Mental Health First Aid. Oh, okay.
Brilliant, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's interesting. Please do call in and tell us more about that. And let us know your name, because it only says TSCW. So, yeah. Thank you so much, Rosie, for sharing of that. And you also mentioned COVID, so you started being ahead of year like before COVID and within COVID as well.
Yeah.
So have you noticed any behavioral changes or challenges since COVID, and have you got any tips of dealing with those changes?
If I'm honest, I mean, I was chatting to one of my colleagues earlier today about this question, and I think if anything, obviously if we're talking about kind of human behaviors, then as I just mentioned before, like the mental health related behaviors obviously have been an increased thing since COVID. Obviously, yeah. there's a lot more kind of anxiety. People are generally a lot more anxious. I mean, we still have a very high degree of mask wearing in our school community as well at the moment, so you can see those behaviors present. But if we were to talk more about kind of like behavior, I would say that particularly last year, while there were quite quite a lot of restrictions in place, I would say that behavior potentially improved. If anything, perhaps maybe some of the younger students were maybe a little bit more boisterous and a little bit more energetic at social times, perhaps maybe being, due to being locked down at home and kind of not being able to blow off that steam. But I know particularly in my context with, we had year bubbles and split lunches and social zones. I think the students responded really well to the kind of routines and expectations that were associated with kind of their safety, really. And I know lots of elements of those restrictions, we've taken kind of the best bits per se and kept that in place this year. So I wouldn't say that there's been a huge change. But like I said, I came into being ahead of year. I think I actually had my interview for my role in the first lockdown. So not that I've noticed. I mean, I don't know if you feel within your context there was a change.
I feel like in terms of motivation, I think that that's gone a bit rocky because you're going from a structured schooling before lockdown, and it's easy to get into the flow. And even myself, I felt it. And then, you know, those structures are taken away when you get home, and then it's online lessons, and then you're back again. So it was a bit like a roller coaster. So I think motivation was affected. And I think not just in my context, but I know in, you know, other contexts, you know, social media, that was quite a big one.
You're absolutely right, and I'm glad that you prompted me on that. There was definitely an increase in social media concerns, and obviously there was the issue of kind of supporting students remotely, not obviously, you know, as a classroom teacher and teaching their lessons, but in regard to like their safeguarding as well. So, you're right. Social media became a tricky issue, and we found that quite quickly we had to educate them a lot, you know very quickly. Obviously year sevens, we found initially last year, had gone from not having not being allowed their phones at primary school, and we allow our students to have phones in social times, and again there was, you know, perhaps some behavioural changes with regard to the usage of phones and the challenges of that. But then, you know, it's kind of a double-edged sword really, because if they need a device, you know, if we're asking them to use devices for their learning, then the lines are blurred slightly as well, aren't they? So that's a good point.
Yeah, I agree with that one. That's a whole nother debate about having phones in school. That's a whole other debate. But if anyone's got any opinions on that, please do call in or text in. And you know, as a new head of year, how did, like, what tips would you give to others seeking to, you know, become a head of year? What could they be doing now? Any tips for application process, or, you know, preparing themselves and so on?
I think definitely, you know, nail being a form tutor, you know, all teachers are pastoral teachers, and I think that and I think that's a really important thing to remember. And, you know, for last year, for example, we kind of, to reduce the movement of students around the school, we actually kind of removed the form tutor elements, and students kind of had a pastoral session in their first lesson. So I think, like, you know, nailing that form tutor role and re-engaging in the, you know, the pastoral pedagogy and pastoral curriculum is really important. You know, hold your students to account, have learning conversations with them, speak to parents. Parents is, you know, a huge part of being a head of year, and it's definitely one of the things that I was, you know, I was really surprised at when I entered the role, at how huge it is. You know, most of my day I will be speaking with parents either face to face in a meeting or over the phone, and I think the more that you can kind of, you know, liaise with parents and have conversations with parents, it will help you kind of prepare for that kind of step up in kind of conversation. Shadow a current head of year if you get the opportunity. A year office, we're lucky to have, you know, a big year office for each year with myself. I work alongside a full-time year coordinator who is full-time there to support students' well-being. There is always things to be done in a year office. There is always something to do or something to observe. So if you know, I know time is so precious, but if you could spend an hour of your, you know, one of your frees in a year office, or you went to work in there, there would be something that you could observe or something that you could work alongside a head of year in doing, and it will give you a real insight to what it is like. And you know, probably the last thing that I will say is there is new pastoral research emerging, which is, you know, which is needed and brilliant. And if we like look, for example, like Stephen Lane, his new book is absolutely brilliant, and I would recommend that anybody wanting to go into, you know, any form of pastoral leadership to read that. And I know I think Maria O'Neill, who is brilliant on Twitter, has written a book. I think it's Proactive Pastoral Care.
Yeah.
So get reading as well. You know, I think it's really important that, like I said, we're, you know, all teachers are pastoral teachers. And if as classroom teachers and teachers of our disciplines and our curriculums, we are really following this researched informed approach to teaching, then why are we not doing that in the pastoral element?
So true.
So yeah, immerse yourself in it.
I love that. And you know, you touch upon, you know, I always send my guests questions beforehand, but you touch on something, but I really, you know, I haven't asked you the question, but I've always, I think it's just quite important as I was listening to you speak. How do you, you know, because you said it's a really big role, so how do you make time for your own mental health and like separate, you know, what has gone on with school, because it's such an emotional role? So how do you separate that and look after your own well-being and your own emotional state, because it can kind of get quite big?
And it can, and you know, sometimes I think, you know, you're not often prepared for things that you may have to deal with, and so on and so forth. But there has to be a degree of kind of switching off.
How do you do that? Because sometimes I find it hard to switch off.
Personally for me, I try, and this is why my working hours, you know, people might think are quite long. I'm you know, at the moment I don't have any children or any dependents, so you know, my time is my own. So I try to work longer hours in the day, and when I leave work, for me that is me not opening my emails, that is me, you know, switching off. For me, the biggest thing that helps me switch off is exercise. And you know, some days, don't get me wrong, I really don't want to get myself to the gym, but one of my favorite things to do is put on a podcast. That's not teaching related. I mean, that there are some brilliant teaching related podcasts out there, but put a podcast on that's, you know, really easy listen, get on the bike at the gym, you know, get some weights out. I also play netball as well.
That's interesting.
I mean, I have actually had a bit of time out because I had a knee injury.
I remember you tweeting about that actually. I hope you're better now.
So I actually went back to my first training session last week, which was really exciting. But I think it's really important that you have something for you that is, you know, it's a mindfulness activity. We teach a lot of mindfulness strategies to our students. So I think it's important that you take your own advice.
I love that.
Whether it's exercise, a sport, even reading a book, you know, if you're reading a book, most of the time you're concentrating on what you're reading. You know, even while the weather's been nice, myself and my partner going on walks and things like that, and just chatting. I quite often try and leave my phone at home as well.
That's a good one.
So there's lots of things, but I think it has to be a conscious choice, and you have to try to do it. But they were the things that I do, and I think that's really important that you do look after yourself, especially in a head of year role.
I really agree with all of those things that you've shared. Thank you, Rosie. And you're so true about exercise, because I always find, like, when I go on a run, when I'm most frustrated or when I feel the most stress, that's the best. that I've done, and I'm not even. I wouldn't even classify myself as a runner, to be honest.
I'm not either. Unless I'm charging around a netball court. Any other form of running, I am not too passionate about.
Yeah, I definitely agree. So my next question is on like advice. So what advice would you give to heads of years on how to other heads of years about how to build positive relationships with students without, you know, having to compromise on high standards and aspirations.
Yeah, definitely. So I think the key thing here is like that you have whatever your expectations are and the standards that you have, that first of all, they're made explicit to your your peer group. You know, how can we expect students to adhere to something that they don't actually know? And we share a lot of that through assemblies. We have lots of notice boards and displays around school that kind of give out those affirmations and expectations. So that's the first thing. I think the second thing as well, and this is a big thing that kind of underpins everything, is trust.
Yeah, I
think you need to show the students and you need to model it yourself that they can trust you. And, you know, if you say that you're going to follow up on something, whether it's, you know, maybe something that's positive or they've asked you for some support or maybe it is a sanction, then you need to kind of follow that up so that they know that the boundaries will be respected. They will feel safe. And I think that's, you know, really, really important here as a head of year is you want your students to basically kind of not feel like they don't know what your next step will be.
Yeah, so it's a bit predictable. It's safe, it's structured. Yeah,
definitely. Because if they feel safe, then they will trust you. And that builds the relationships without you having to drop your standards in terms of discipline. And I think that all relationships need to be built that, you know, they're rooted in mutual respect and to show students that it's not one way, that you will show them respect and you will listen to them, you know, if they do the same thing. And one of the really nice things that I kind of have read recently, and I can't for the life of me remember what it was in, and I'll have to have a look at the end of the show, was this idea of looking for rubies. And I think what's really important is reaffirming the positives before addressing the negative behaviours.
Oh, I love that,
And I know that in the walkthrough series, they talk about the dot in the empty square. And I think, you know, as classroom teachers, as, you know, pastoral providers, if there is, you know, some challenging behaviour or there's something that needs to be disciplined, it's quite often very easy for you to hone in on that one behaviour rather than the rest of that empty square being those positives. And I think that by kind of that idea of looking for rubies and perhaps reaffirming the positives before the negatives, it kind of follows that restorative model as well.
Yeah.
But it again reaffirms that relationship between you and your students.
I love that. And it's so true about, you know, gaining their trust and following through with what you say,
absolutely,
irrespective if it's negative or positive. So I really like that. Even as a classroom teacher myself, I'm just taking so much nuggets from you. So thank you.
And I think as well, sorry, Emily, it's just, know your students and learn your students. You know, for any head of year, you know, my year size, we have 260 students in my year, and that is a lot of students to learn names and, you know, and the things about them. But it's really important to try and do that and to be active, whether, you know, you're on duty or on the corridor, because if you know your students and you know something about them, that, again, it just builds that relationship and strengthens it as well. Go on.
I was going to ask you, sorry, how do you know your students with such, you know, a vast year group? So how do you, like, learn their names and learn them? Do you have any tips for heads of years that may be listening to learn their students?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we have a big kind of culture of presence of the year teams around the school. So in the mornings, greeting students as they're coming in. When they're in form, I try and make a point of like visiting each classroom in the morning, and just kind of stopping students and having conversations with them. You know, I have several duties in a week of where I'm in the dining hall with my students, and you know, it's just having a chat with them and how was your weekend, you know, how are you getting on? Which subjects have you been enjoying the most at the moment? Because even the tiniest bits of, you know, even the tiny nuggets of information really can strengthen a relationship. So, you know, for example, this morning, I went into one of my form tutor's classrooms and then we were just having a conversation and she said, well, I'm just telling the students about how maths is the best subject. And I was like, maths is the best subject. And then one of the students chirped up and was like, yeah, it's better than history. And I was like, oh, right. Is it better than history then? I was like, right, I'll remind you next time you want to slip in the front of the queue so you can go to netball. And, you know, all those kinds of conversations that, you know, you don't have to sit down and arrange a meeting with every student builds that relationship. And again, when there are situations where you maybe have to have a difficult conversation with them, or that, you know, there has been a sanction, or there needs to be discipline, you can tap into that, and that's hugely useful and gives you a lot of leverage, I think, as a head of year.
Thank you, that's really great tips, because I feel like when students know that you know them and then you're making that effort, I guess that aids in building trust.
Absolutely.
As well. And then my last question is, what does like a perfect, quote unquote, cause there's nothing that's perfect, but what does like a perfect or the most effective pastoral provision look like to you?
So yeah, this is a really interesting question. And again, one that I've had a bit of a think about and a bit of a chat to friends and colleagues as well. And like you said, you know, you've quote unquote perfect, because what I would say is that there isn't necessarily a one size fits all perfect pastoral provision, because I think a lot of what you will offer will be dependent on your context. It will be dependent on your students and your school community as well. And there will be things that, you know, you maybe need to focus on in a little bit more detail than perhaps some other things. But some of the key ingredients, I say first of all would be a well-planned and research-informed pastoral curriculum. So one that takes students on a learning journey, much like, you know, a subject, discipline, a journey through core elements of knowledge that we want them to learn about. And I think that should be explicitly taught, whether it's in the form of a PHSRE lesson, whether that it's in an assembly, whether that it's in a conversation. But I think that it should form these, and I read this recently, so I'm not going to claim this quote for myself, but it should form kind of golden threads that all staff can articulate and repeat and incorporate. And I think that that is key. So definitely that. Definitely, you know, the usual kind of expectations that is associated with pastoral elements. So, you know, the monitoring of attendance, punctuality and behaviour, because again, all those things have such a positive correlation with student academic success, and progress here is a huge part of the head of year role. And I think it's one that's overlooked a lot. But particularly with COVID, you know, I'm sure that, you know, the national picture is apparent that there has become, you know, a widening of this attainment gap, and a huge part of a perfect provision would be, you know, support for students that need, you know, that extra bit of help and support with their learning and progress. And I think character education as well is really important. So developing students' self-independence, that's going to be a huge thing moving forward. Resilience and how to keep themselves mentally and physically healthy, and educating them as citizens in the 21st century world is key.
Those are really good points and key characteristics that they need in order to navigate, you know, the current climate that we are in, like, you know, resilience especially. And then before you go, what are you most proud of in terms of, you know, your team, in terms of the way that you've navigated this new role and what you've done as a head of year? What would you say so far on your head of year journey you are most proud of?
I think it's the resilience and the confidence of my students. And, you know, they technically this year, I mean, I'm head of year 8 this year, they were in year 7 last year, but they came back last week as if that they had been in the school for years. They knew where they were going. They'd all checked their timetables via their emails. Their uniform was absolutely perfect. And I think that resilience and that confidence and the bravery that I hoped that, you know, the culture that we've worked as a team to build has kind of instilled in those students. So I would say that they're a brilliant year group, and I work with some brilliant colleagues who are very, very supportive. So I would say that that's probably what I'm most proud of.
Thank you, Rosie. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, no, absolutely.
This has been so useful as a classroom teacher as well. More useful, I think, for those that want to get into the field of being a head of year, as well as those that are already in it. For those that may have not heard of you before, how can people get in contact with you and pose more questions? Do you want to share your Twitter handle, please?
Yeah, sure. So you can reach me at @MissyS_teach. I'll just type that into the chat now for everyone. So feel free to get in touch. Follow, send me a message. I'm absolutely more than happy to help anyone give advice with applications or anything like that at all. Just feel free to reach out, and we'll go from there.
Thank you so much, Rosie. So just to reiterate what she just said, so it's at @MissCS_CS. I have, you know, tweeted Rosie when I advertise the show, so you can also find her DMs via that post. Her page. Page, yeah. Right, that post is actually @MissCS_teach. So sorry about that. So thank you so much, Rosie. Please feel free to stay on if you want to.
Absolutely.
Or if you're really busy, you can go. It's completely up to you, but it would be lovely to have you. I'm just going to pass it over to Gail now to share the latest educational news.
This is Teachers Talk Radio. And this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
This is your latest Teachers Talk Radio News with Gail Glenn. Ofsted have admitted that its inspectors were not highlighting off-rolling when it was identified in schools. Ofsted has told their inspectors that they must use the specific term off-rolling in their report if they find that it is taking place in a school. Ofsted defines off-rolling as the practice of removing a pupil from the school roll without a formal permanent exclusion, or by encouraging a parent to remove their child from the school roll where the removal is primarily in the interests of the school rather than in the interests of the pupil. Off-rolling in these circumstances is a form of gaming. In an update to inspectors, it adds, some schools have issued press releases stating that off-rolling was not found because Ofsted did not use those words. Reports which have already been issued cannot be amended. Ofsted were reported in the Times Educational Supplement to have told inspectors that reports must always use the following set phrase to refer to off-rolling. This practice constitutes off-rolling, according to Ofsted's definition. The Guardian newspaper has reported that a survey of more than 20,000 working parents has found that 96% believed that not enough was being done to support parents with the cost of childcare. One third of parents said they spent less on their rent or mortgage than they did on childcare. 100,000 parents signed a petition asking for an independent review of childcare funding and affordability. This has triggered a debate on childcare in Parliament this week. The Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development has released data which puts the UK as the third highest childcare system in the world. A full-time place costs, on average, £12,376 a year. The Department for Education said parents' ability to claim 33 hours a week during term time for 3 and 4-year-olds could save them up to £5,000 a year. This has been your daily education news briefing.
And welcome back. So previously I had Rosie joining us, and she dropped so many gems in terms of becoming an head of peer, how to prepare, organisational tips, getting to know your students. So that has been interesting. So still in the theme of pastoral roots, I'm going to interview Sarah. She is my colleague with extensive experience in terms of teaching and learning, as well as working in pastoral as well. So welcome, Sarah.
Hi, Emily. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. It's so lovely to have you.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to be on here.
So I just wanted to, you know, if you could just introduce yourself and, you know, your journey into education.
Yeah, so I am Sarah Adeniga, and I am an English teacher, but also a lead practitioner in quite a unique role this year, actually. So it's a lead practitioner that's responsible for teaching and learning, but also pastoral and inclusion, so behavior and inclusion as well. Now, in terms of my journey, I've had quite an interesting journey. So I started off as a lead practitioner, primarily for improving best practice in literacy and in English and teaching, mentoring teachers to become good to outstanding practitioners. And then I moved across to pastoral side, where I was in charge of behaviour and inclusion.
Thank you so much, Sarah. And
I should have added, yeah.
Yeah, and you didn't mention, you know, your master's and where you got your master's from. I always say this to her.
You're always encouraging me to talk about that, but I guess I just try to be a bit modest. I studied at Cambridge University, and I did a master's in advanced subject teaching, primarily because I wanted to improve my knowledge and theory and teaching practice. I have a real passion for improving progress, so for students, especially vulnerable students, to make good progress. It was a great opportunity for me to study at Cambridge and do this extensive research to find out ways and methods to bridge the gap between pupil premium and non-pupil premium students for, like, mainly GCSEs. Because there was, at the time in the school that I was working in, there was a big attainment gap between pupil premium and non-pupil premium students. So I really wanted to do this research to find out how teachers and how a school can take a whole approach in order to improve best practice to narrow that gap.
And out of interest, Sarah, I know this is a question that I sent to you. What did you come to discover your research in terms of, you know, narrowing the gap?
So there was a lot. So I would say that the main, there isn't a one size fits all. There isn't just one answer. It's a combination of things, and yeah. It has to be a whole school approach where it's not just the individual teacher. But I'll talk about the research that I did. So I looked at the data, so the data of my students and my class, and compared it with, so with these particular students, had like a small focus group, and I compared their data with other subjects and yeah. interviewed the students, observed lessons, where I got to speak to students about, okay, these are the lessons that you are doing well in. Are they the same lessons that you would say that you enjoy? And what was really interesting is that the students were doing better at subjects that they felt they were getting the most feedback in. It wasn't necessarily the subject they liked the best. So one of the, I can quote Ryan and Deci, where they talk about feelings of autonomy in students, that helps yeah. with progress. So for example, when students feel that they are good at a subject, so that feeling of autonomy where you give them that sense of control, so with certain activities where you scaffold the task for them and then they get to do it on their own, that encourages attainment, positive attainment, self-accomplishment, so regular feedback, and that could be verbal feedback in class, marking of books, assessments, so after assessments, providing that feedback and ways to improve. And that can actually help with their extrinsic motivation, because motivation, what I found in my research, did equate to positive outcomes. So motivating those students to want to learn and to be engaged helped with positive outcomes. And sometimes students don't necessarily have that intrinsic motivation. For example, with English, which is a core subject, there are many times students come into my class and say, I hate English, I'm not good at it. So you have that mammoth task as an English teacher to try and get them to be motivated. And it's using methods to encourage extrinsic motivation with the techniques that I've just mentioned. But with all of that, it leads to positive emotional engagement.
Yeah.
The student builds that positive relationship with you, and they feel that actually, by the advice that you've given me, the regular feedback, I actually feel that I can succeed. That's what I'd say that I found out from the research. That was interesting.
And it's so interesting because, you know, the Education Endowment Foundation has said that one of the most effective tool in terms of increasing attainment is feedback. I think that has to be number one on the list. And then number two was metacognition. So what you said about feedback is so true. But thanks.
Sorry, I forgot to mention the name of the book for Ryan and Deci. It's called Self-Determination Theory.
Yeah, so I would
recommend that, yeah.
Oh, thank you, Sarah. So I just wanted to ask you, because I know you've also got extensive, experience in pastoral as well as teaching and learning, and I've seen you in action. How do you deal with challenging students? Because I've seen Sarah talk to some challenging students, and I'm not the sort of person that goes from 0 to 100. I mean, you know, just 0 or 10. I go from 100. I'm just like, and I know that's not the most effective way, but I'm sure there's other teachers that are so guilty with that. But Sarah will just talk in a nice, calm manner. And just watching her do that has, maybe be a bit more patient. So, so if you could tell, everyone, how do you deal with challenging students? Because I've just seen, you at work and you are just really patient. You always speak in such a calm tone, but you don't mince your words at the same time.
Do you mean challenging students in a classroom or in a lesson or in the hallway or in a corridor
So let's start off with in a hallway and then in a classroom.
I think first and foremost, it's like what you said, in terms of making sure that you stay calm. So that is part of, I would say, a de-escalation method. Also, remove the audience. Some students who are challenging
tend to, they like spectators. Yeah. So I would say sort of single out that student who is particularly challenging and just say, I need to speak to you and I'd like the rest of you to move away so that I can actually speak to this particular student. Make sure that you remain calm and positive. So it is that use of positive language. I appreciate, so let's say if a student is being particularly loud, I appreciate that you're really excited about going to your next lesson. That is not the correct way to behave. I'd like to speak to you alone. The rest of you can go to your lesson. I'd like to speak to you alone. Get them to think about their actions. So I think self-reflection is definitely important. Get them to self-reflect on their behavior. Why do you think I've pulled you up? A lot of the time students can feel that they're a victim. Oh, you're picking on me. It wasn't me. Get them to think about their actions. Why do you think I've pulled you over? Do you think you're behaving in the appropriate way? I think Rose talked about character education before, and it's really great to link to character education and say, so for example, in the school that we work at, we have the BA way, and just say, is this part of the character education that we've taught you? Is this going to make you a valuable citizen for the future? So again, linking to the character education of the whole school and getting that student to think about, you are part of this school community. Are you a valuable member of that community? And having that conversation and remaining calm and positive language is definitely important as well.
Thank you so much, Sarah. And how about in a classroom? Like, how would you deal with challenging behavior in a classroom?
Okay, so I mean, with that example that I gave, that was pretty much if someone's really loud, but it all depends on what the incident is. I mean, I wouldn't use that if it was a fight that happened, for example. In the classroom, first and foremost, I think it's important for a teacher to think about whether their lesson is planned well.
Yeah.
I always believe that with a well-planned lesson, you generally get well-behaved students. And by well-planned, I don't just mean a well-structured lesson. Mm-hmm. I mean, is it an inclusive learning environment? Have you planned for every single learner in that classroom? Have you planned for the low ability student, the more able student, the vulnerable student? And sort of reflect on that. And then even after that, you still get a challenging student, then again, it's sort of the same things I mentioned before. So building positive relationships is really important, setting those clear expectations. I've used a lot of that, obviously, the first week going back to school. You have your new classes where some of the students might not know who you are as a teacher.
Yeah.
They might have heard of you, but it's very different. You're a teacher, and these students are trying to get a feel for you and figure out the type of teacher that you are. And I think what's really worked well is setting those clear expectations from the beginning and those rules from the beginning. And equally asking the students, what would you expect of me as your teacher? And every time I've asked that question to students, they have always said that they want a teacher who is strict but fair. It's shocking, but you would think they'll say, oh yeah, we want a teacher who is cool and fun and lets us do what we want. But actually, all students that I've asked have said, we want a teacher who is firm but fair.
And
I remember reading, yes, go on.
Oh, no, sorry, Sarah, to cut you off. I just never thought to ask. I'm going to ask my students that. What would you want from a teacher next time that they accuse me of being extra or, you know, long, as they say? So I'm definitely going to pose that question. And it ties in with what Rosie said earlier on in terms of being students really having that sense of predictability and structure and feeling safe, because I feel like being that warm, strict evokes that safety and, do you know what I mean, that predictability?
Yeah, definitely. Students respect a teacher who is, I would say, maybe strict is the best word, but firm and consistent with the rules, consistent with their expectations, having high expectations of their students. And I can quote Bill Rogers in his book, Behavior Management, A Whole School Approach, where he talks about positive languages and building those positive relationships, which I think is really important, but also showing that you are offering that type of support for challenging students. I mean, I could give two examples where earlier on in my career, I had a situation where I wanted students to complete a task on their own. They had to read a text and answer the questions. And this was a class that I'd just taken. So all the students were doing their work, and there was this one boy who hadn't done his work. And I remember at the end of the lesson, I said, right, I'm only going to dismiss those that have completed the work. So we got to him. So everyone said, oh, you know, I've completed it. They read out some of their answers. And I said, okay, can you read out your answer? And he said, no, I don't want to. And I remember saying, oh, how dare you? And kind of, I guess, it put the attention on him. And this is one of the most extreme cases, but he actually started insulting me in front of the whole class and picked up a chair. This was a school in South, but he picked up a chair and said, oh, you know, I'm going to throw this chair at you. And afterwards, when I reflect on that, so that was early on in my career, I found out that he struggled to read or write. So he had, he had really low literacy levels. Now, if I were to do that lesson again, I would have walked around the class and checked on their work before I asked for feedback. And I would have noticed that he hadn't done the work, and I've had that conversation. So again, it's sort of offering that support, building that positive relationship and saying, right, do you need any help? So then fast forward to nowadays, I've got this year 8 class. There's a particular student who hadn't done any work. And I went up to him, I approached him, and I said, I've realized you haven't done any work. And he said, yeah, I know I haven't. And this is a new class. And even after that conversation I had with him, he still refused to do any work. So I'm going to be really candid here and say that sometimes when you try your best, you do get students that don't respond to you.
And that's by the end of the
lesson, by the end of the lesson, he hadn't completed the work. But what I did is, again, you take away the audience, that's de-escalation. It could have really embarrassed him if I said, you know, you still haven't done any work, even despite the fact I've given you all this help, you're going to stay back. But I took away the audience, I left him alone, and I just focused on everyone else. Then at the end of lesson, I said, can I have a word with you? I'm going to wait for everyone to leave. And I had an honest conversation with him and said, is there anything you want to tell me? How do you find English? I just want to let you know that there's no, because he started to get quite defensive and a little bit rude. And I thought, okay, I'm going to just leave him to it. And I just said, look, I don't know what's happened in your previous lessons with your previous teachers, but let's start on a clean slate. I'm here to support you. So having those honest conversations and knowing that, I guess, kind of showing that student that you are there for them and you are there for them to achieve. That's most important.
I love that, Sarah. Thank you so much for sharing. And, you know, I had an instance where I think I told you about, you know, a girl that didn't want to read. I was really angry about that. And then, you know, just thinking about, you know, how I could have done that better today. Year 11 student said, but miss, do I have to read? And I was like, yes, please. I thought, okay, let me just do a compromise. Just do one sentence and then I'll just pass it on to someone else.
Yeah, that's a really good compromise, because you're not lowering your expectations, are you? You're still expecting her to read. But actually, and again, that's another way, finding that middle ground compromise. Yeah. You're saying, okay, you just read that one sentence.
Thank you so much for that. And, I'm just going to pose, you know, just one scenario to you because of time. And the common scenario is, you know, students calling out in class. I think that is, actually, I'll do two. So student calling out in class, how would you deal, you know, with that scenario? An NQT or maybe a more experienced teacher is going through this, that constant low level. Actually, I wouldn't even class that as low level. I think that's actually more than low level, shouted out. So how would you, like, deal with that situation of calling out and shouting out?
So are you, because sorry.
In lesson, sorry. Oh, sorry. So can you hear me now?
I can hear you now. Sorry. So how would I
deal with students that are constantly calling out in lessons?
So would it be a group of students or one student or the whole class just calling out?
One student, I would say.
Okay. If you have set your expectations from the beginning with your class, they would know not to call out.
Yeah.
And if you have that one student that calls out, again, it's reminding them of your expectations.
Yeah.
You know, so reminding them, you know, we have discussed my expectations. We have discussed that it is not polite to call out. You need to put your hand up. And if it's consistent, I would say, right, give warnings and follow the school behavior policy. Give warnings and say, okay, this is a warning. If you carry on, I will have to follow the behavior policy, write their names down. But I would be careful because I know that some teachers like to write names down on the board. And I would say it depends on your class and it depends on the particular student. So I find that if it's a student who wouldn't respond very well to their name being on the board for something negative, a really good trick is to write it down on a piece of paper at your desk, but be visible to that student that you're writing their name down in your book and look at them and say, I am writing your name down in my book. And I would say that that's rather effective when you pull them up on that behavior that is not fulfilling your expectations, reminding them that you know this is an expectation not to call out, and I'm going to give you a warning, and if you continue, then I'm going to have to sanction according to the behavior policy.
Thank you so much, Sarah, for that. I know, Rosie, you're still here with us, so if you've got anything you want to chip in at any time, please do feel free, because I'm sure that you have to support a lot of staff that teach you right at your school with maybe some low level behavior or other things as well. My next question, you mentioned this quite a lot, Sarah, about de-escalation. Can you talk us through what methods are most effective?
Okay, so I think it's really important to remind ourselves as teachers that we are the adults.
Yeah.
It's very easy to, I guess, be very proud and think to yourself that how dare that student disrespect me. But sometimes, I'd say a lot of the time, it's about humility and just saying to yourself, okay, I need to understand that I'm the adult and I am not going to raise my voice. I'm going to keep this same, you know, this calm tone. I'm reminding that a student that I'm going to, this is the way that I'm talking and I want you to talk in the same tone that I'm talking.
Yeah.
So ensuring that you calm down, having empathy. So depending on what the situation is, you would say to the student, I understand that you may feel this way. Correct me if I'm wrong. However, this is my expectation. And this is what the outcome is. This is what the outcome I expect to be. And I think having that clear dialogue and remaining calm is key, and having empathy is also key. But most importantly, being conscious of the fact that you need to be humble, because I have had situations where in front of, you know, I can think of a particular student who is, you know, was rather confrontational, and in the whole canteen and in front of quite a few people, and I was in a leadership role at this time, so it was very public, and I think he was misbehaving in the canteen, and I said, right, you need to leave. And he became quite confrontational in front of quite a few people and became quite aggressive. Now, with pride, you would think to yourself, how dare this individual disrespect me in front of all these people? And you're inclined to shout back or raise your voice.
Yeah.
But it took a lot. It took a lot for me to be humble and just say really calmly, that is not how you speak to me. I will not accept that. And I'm not going to stay here and allow you to disrespect me. You need to think about your actions. I'm going to walk away and I'm going to find you later. And we're going to talk about this because this is unacceptable, and just walk off.
Wow. Yeah.
And actually, that particular student came to find me and apologized.
Oh, wow.
And I said to him, I would really appreciate it if you apologize in front of your friends so that they know that that's not the right behavior. So he said, fine. So his friends surrounded him and he said, I'd like to apologize to Miss for my behavior. It's unacceptable.
Oh, I love that. And I really, really do like that, because I've had in the past, when you do show humility as well, that we've got someone joined.
Hello, Liz, how are you?
Hiya. I'm good. Hold on for 1 second. So when you do show that humility as well, what I tend to find in the classroom is that some students start to, you know, say, you know, that's quite bad what you did. And like they become on the teacher's side and it kind of works out as well. Like, do you know what I mean? And they become like that encouragement, not encouragement, but kind of become that window of showing to, you know, the child that was, kind of being that's naughty, right, and rude, what they did was wrong. And I've had that sort of scenarios on several occasions, like, you know, in quote unquote, oh, what you did to Miss was bad, mine, you were a bit extra, you know, but things that the students say. And it really does work when you show that humility. I really do like that, Sarah, thank you for that. And it comes with emotional intelligence as well, but, you know, sometimes just, you know, being real as well, I've had the instances where all my emotional intelligence goes out the window and I'm just like, and I become Miss Trunchbull. So, I think what you said there was fantastic. We did have a caller, so I don't know where he's gone. I don't know if he wanted to ask a question. So, sorry about that, Sarah. Did you have anything else to say about de-escalation or any further tips?
Another way is to remove the remove that child from the situation. Obviously, if things, you know, it's important that if the situation causes, you have a legal obligation to safeguard your students. So obviously, if it's a situation where it is a danger, so if there's a fight that's happened and it's a danger to other students in the class, then obviously you need to remove the danger from that situation, so things can be quite difficult. So you can't use that de-escalation method that I just mentioned of, okay, you know, positive language, think about their actions. You just act accordingly and you get a student to find someone to support, and in the meantime you try to separate the situation and I would say move the students away that's causing danger to the other students. So obviously things are, it depends on the situation. If it's one student who's been particularly aggressive, where, you know, because I've had situations where a student has become quite aggressive and is angry with the whole class, angry with the teacher, and just wants to lash out at someone, then remove that student from the class, because actually that particular environment is not helping them. Mm-hmm. So remove them and just say, look, I think you need a moment outside. Step outside just to calm down. So that's another way. But it depends on the scenario and the situation.
Yeah. Thank you, Sarah. And just in line with that, how do you support, you know, teachers that might not have strong behavior management or might be struggling with certain students? Because, you know, you've been in leadership roles and you're a lead practitioner. So, you know, based on your experience as well, so how have you supported behavior management amongst staff, and what tips could you give to heads of years or those that are in you know, pastoral roles to support others with behavior management?
Well, I'm quite excited about trying out the instructional coaching method from the Ambitious Institute, but I would say that the mentoring side or the mentoring techniques that I use is similar to instructional coaching, but I'll sort of focus on that in a bit. But the main thing is that you observe the teacher's lesson and then you identify the areas that have gone wrong. You meet with that teacher. And what I like to do, which is similar to instructional coaching, is asking the teacher, you know, talk through your lesson with me. What outcome did you want? And how do you think it worked out? Do you think that you achieved your outcome? And getting them to self-reflect, that's what I would normally do when I've mentored teachers. Then what I'd like to sort of change towards instructional coaching, but I did initially, was I would ask them to think about, okay, what are the different ways that, what are different techniques that you could use to improve to improve the initial technique that you used. For example, when, especially with trainees, it's very important for them to polish and hone in on how students enter the classroom. And I guess focusing on the littlest things, such as ensuring that students enter the classroom quietly and taking off their outerwear. So just start off small, taking off their
routines.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The regular routine, getting their books open. And if, let's say, a trainee teacher doesn't do that, I might say, okay, what could you have done differently? What would you expect? But what I'm quite excited about with instructional coaching is that it's quite granular, where you give them these steps and they act out the steps in front of you. So I'm quite excited to do that. But I would say in the past, what I have done is getting them to self-reflect, talk about their lesson, getting them to think about the methods they could use to improve, and also visiting other teachers. So I would identify the teachers that have really strong behavior management and get those, you know, the trainees or the mentee to visit the teachers to find out how the methods and techniques that they use for effective behavior management, then they would use it in their own lesson. I'll come back to observe and see how it's worked.
Oh, I love that. Thank you, Sarah. And, you know, still dealing with, you know, staff, sometimes students have a breakdown in relationships with their teachers, or students have a breakdown relationship with their peers. So how do you ensure an effective or lead on or conduct, I should say, an effective restorative conversations to repair those relationships?
I mean, so just to be clear on the question, do you mean if I was to have a restorative conversation with a student?
Yeah, if you were conducting a restorative conversation with, you know, a staff member and a student, or a student with a student, what's tips for effective, you know, conductions, I should say, of restorative conversations?
So when I have mediated restorative conversations between a teacher and a student, there, it's normally a breakdown of communication. And when you speak to individual parties, they generally just don't understand what has happened. And it's important for them to talk about it in a more calmer environment. It's quite difficult to do that in a situation where feelings are heightened. So taking them out of that situation and getting each individual to just talk about why do you feel aggrieved? So the teacher, why do you feel aggrieved? The student, why do you feel aggrieved? But ultimately, what I think is important is the student being clear on what the expectations of a teacher are.
Wow.
I think that's very important, that students understand that, okay, your teacher is there to ensure you make academic progress, and whatever actions that they have done, is that to support your academic progress? And most times the student would say, yeah, it is. Now, the actions that you took, was that supporting your own academic progress?
I love that.
And it's just just ensuring that the student is aware what the role and the duty of a teacher is, and has that teacher acted according to that? And that's what normally works. And then giving the student opportunity to talk about why they might be upset. So the most recent situation I can think of is when a student had her phone out because someone from home had called her and she felt it was really important. And the teacher had said, look, put your phone away. And the student said, oh, it's my, you know, it's someone from home. And the teacher said, you know, I don't care who it is, hang up. And the student had got quite sensitive about that and had insulted the teacher and said, what do you mean you don't care? And walked out. But when I got the two together, I used the same method where I spoke to a student and said, okay, the teacher's obligation is to ensure that you learn in that lesson. Was she right to tell you off having your phone out? Yes, she was. Okay. Now, why are you upset? Oh, because she said she doesn't care who's called me. And the teacher explained, I didn't mean I don't care about the person at home. I meant, so it was just sort of having that dialogue to communicate.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
When the student felt that her voice was heard, because she said, okay, wow. I was able to talk about what upset me. And now I understand that the teacher didn't mean it, like it wasn't personal to me. They were just making sure that I was focused in the lesson. And I just said, and again, linking to the rules of the school, do you understand you're not allowed your phone out? Yeah. Was Miss Wright to tell you you shouldn't have had your phone out? Yes. Sticking, so referring to the school rules, referring to the expectations of a teacher, so what are the teacher expectations and what their obligation is as a teacher, always works, because then the student can't really argue back and think, okay, the teacher has acted within their rights then.
This is so good. I'm learning so much. Thank you, Sarah. And obviously, as I said before, I've seen you in action. So I feel like, you know, you're really good at building relationships. I remember last year before year 11s left, Sarah's office tables filled, and you know, she was senior leader then, and I haven't seen, you know, in my 7 years being a teacher, that many gifts given to a senior leader, of, you know, gifts, cards. And what really touched me was the fact that most of the gifts and the cards were from, you know, students that were very, really, very challenging. But to Sarah, they're not, like, she could understand why other teachers would find them challenging, but she never sees them as challenging. But trust me when I say they are characters. you know those sort of students that if you see that they're in, you're like, oh, like that. Those are the students I'm talking about. So Sarah, can you talk us through, like, how do you build positive relationships with students?
Oh, okay, that's an interesting one. I would say empathy and getting to know the students is really important. And within my role of being in charge of behavior and inclusion, it's important that you provide a pastoral provision that caters to their emerging needs and caters to their environment. So with those particular students that you mentioned, it's having those conversations with them and asking, you know, do you feel supported? Being up to date with what's happening in the world, in their world. So, you know, we know that at the moment with the whole pandemic, mental health is hit the roof in terms of the amount of cases of mental health. And I would say in particular areas, in the area that is, you know, our school is in, there's youth violence. So understanding more about that and having those honest conversations with the students about, you know, how are you? How are you coping? And I have read in the local newspaper that this incident happened, and how do you stay safe? What can the school do to support you? Then thinking about what methods we can use to support the students. And then the students are quite open. They might say, well, it would be great to have some mentoring. So then within my role, I was able to research mentoring companies and provide that mentoring. Also making sure that you have a close network of safeguarding groups. So being in touch with the safeguarding lead, being in touch with the borough and any organizations that are linked to the borough, having those conversations, networking and working together, you know, with the school support officer as well. So the school police officer, and thinking about what support that you can offer those students in school. So networking is key, speaking to the students, finding out how we can support them. And actually, I created a student body, a student voice, because I thought it was important for students to be able to regularly communicate with someone from the senior team to discuss, okay, this is what we feel would help us to feel safe and supported in school, for us to make progress and for us to feel happy. and a place that we belong.
And that was called, that's called for those that want to know more, the junior leadership team, which has made, you know, a tremendous impact. And I feel like Sarah, you should definitely, you know, create a blog post and write a post about the junior leadership team, because that's literally, that was your vision, and it's, you know, made a tremendous impact, as I said before. So yeah. I think those are all my questions. Before we close, because I'm aware that it is 9:30, how can people get in contact with you, and, you know, follow you on Twitter? What is your handle?
Yeah, I need to, that's my goal, to be more active on Twitter. But my Twitter handle is Ms. MS underscore Adenuga underscore. So yes, I plan to be more active on Twitter.
Please do follow Sarah, as well as Rosie. And I really want to thank both of you for joining me today. It's been a pleasure. And yeah, thank you so much. I hope you both enjoy the rest of your week. And yeah, thank you. Next week, we are going to be discussing leadership. So stay tuned on Twitter to find out who I will be interviewing next week. So thank you once again, Rosie, and thank you once again, Sarah. I hope you have a lovely evening. Goodbye, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye.
Creative Resources, made for teachers by teachers. At Creative Resources, we've been rethinking what a classroom can be. We've created a huge range of more than 2,500 original and exciting resources that span across more than 15 different subject areas. Whether you're looking for primary or secondary level resources, careers options, PSHE, arts or humanities, Creative Resources have the resources for you. We offer full curriculum packages and unique, challenging escape rooms themed on topics such as Shakespeare, Tudors, and fractions. We have quizzes, task cards, Tarsia puzzles, and lots more. Better still, more than 100 resources can be accessed for free. Just visit our website, www.creativeresources.com. You can get 10% off any order you make on our website by using the discount code TT Radio. Creative Resources, made for teachers by teachers. Every teacher loves stationery, right? Imagine getting a selection of fun, beautiful and unique stationery items designed and selected especially for teachers, delivered through your door every month. You need to check out teacherslovestationery.club.
I'm always so excited when the box arrives. It's such a treat.
My Teachers Love Stationery Club box is just a little treat to myself every month.
It's always full of delightful and surprising items, including some really good quality stationery brands like Faber-Castell and Stabilo.
And because you never know what you're going to get, it makes it even more fun and special when you get it.
It feels really great to be supporting a family business that's run by real teachers. I can't help feeling like they just know what I'm going to enjoy using stationery-wise better than I do myself.
Visit teacherslovestationery.club and enter the code TTRadio when you buy your first stationery box to save £2 today. Teacherslovestationery.club. This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio